Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today I've brought to the program a very interesting author. J.A. Leary is here to talk about his new supernatural fantasy novel, The Angel Hunter. J.A. Leary was educated as a mathematician and computer scientist. He holds a bachelor's degree from the University of Central Florida and a master's from Boston College. An avid reader from a young age, storytelling was always in the back of his mind. After a personal awakening into consciousness that began in his mid-30s, J.A. began sensing a different path for his life, and his love of fiction writing developed after a long career as a software engineer, a profession that has allowed him the privilege of working on America's space program at NASA's Kennedy Space Center. He openly admits a timeless infatuation with his wife, Annette, whom he married in 1987. She was his first motivation to write and the inspiration for Victoria Hunter, who is the main character in The Angel Hunter. So I'm so happy to have John on the phone today. Welcome to Inside Scoop Live, John.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here, and really congratulations on your new book. I believe this is your first published work?
It is.
Must feel great to have it on shelves.
It is great, and it's been a long road. It's been many, many years of not only learning how to write, but also how to make the right business contacts and learning about the publishing business to get the book to the state that it's in today.
Mm-hmm. Well, when did you start actually writing this project?
Well, many years ago, being an avid reader, I read a book by Elizabeth Clare Prophet, which is a dissertation on the Book of Enoch. Mm-hmm. Now, the Book of Enoch is an uncanonized Old Testament manuscript that is attributed to the prophet Enoch, that talks about the race of fallen angels that took great favor with the beauty and elegance of mortal women and had children with them. And that race of children became known as the Nephilim.
Mm-hmm.
And they are referenced in other parts of the Bible. But I found the story so fascinating, and I just couldn't stop thinking about it for months after I read it. And then I was probably driving to work one day or driving home, and I thought to myself, what would happen if a young woman had a experience like that today with a fallen angel, a watcher, and had his children? What would her story be?
Mm.
And that is the story of Victoria Hunter.
How interesting. So why don't we hear much about this, the Book of Enoch, and this whole story? I mean, I've heard of this, and I've heard of Elizabeth Clare Prophet, but this isn't mainstream.
No, it's not. And when the Bible was being canonized, especially the Old Testament in the early part of the rise of Christianity in the first and second century, Enoch at one point was part of the canonized Bible. But what they did was they started to remove parts of the manuscripts that they considered either heretical or in conflict with what they wanted to practice as a religion. And fallen angels coming down from heaven and having sex with young mortal women was not what they considered moral.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't a story that they cared to tell. However, the thing that I always found strange is that they left references in the Old Testament to the Watchers, and even stories like David slaying Goliath. Goliath was a Philistine, and there are theologians today that believe the Philistines, the Nephilim, was the race of giants.
Oh, interesting. Well, okay, so with no references in the Bible to what the Nephilim are, what do readers of the Bible expect them to be? Who do they think the Nephilim are?
I don't think that's something that's... No, I was raised a Catholic, and the mainstream Christian churches don't teach anything about that. The thing about the history of humanity is we have a very, very cloudy background. There is more and more science coming to light today that this whole concept of Adam and Eve being in the garden is really being... That's a myth. It's a metaphor of the creation of humanity, and there's really no factual basis for it when it comes right down to it. When you put it under the microscope of modern science, now we know from mapping of the human genome that somewhere in antiquity, in the past, there was a splice done in the human DNA.
Uh-huh.
Now, it's an artificial splice. Scientists know that. Where it came from and who was responsible, we don't know. But somewhere along the line, the creation of the first man, the Adamu, as it's referred to in Mesopotamian texts, took place. And somebody did it. Now, in the Bible, the metaphor of Adam is it's attributed to the God Jehovah, or whoever you believe the creator is. But we know outside the religious context that that really isn't true. So it leaves open a whole question of where did we, there's still an answer of where did we come from and what is our real genetic lineage? Mm-hmm. And we don't know.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating stuff. With this book by Elizabeth Clare Prophet, where did she get her information from?
Well, she read the Book of Enoch, of course, but she makes she has some theories that that the offspring of the Watchers are even around today and are in high levels of government and are responsible for a good bit of corruption in the world.
Yes.
That to me is a little bit too cloak and daggerish. Mm. I believe that the true spirit of humanity is essentially good, and there are things that get in our way as we go through life, depending on where we're raised. You know, the people that are the Islamic terrorists, they believe what they're doing is right because that's what they've been taught from a young age. They've been taught to hate and taught to destroy, mm-hmm. and they believe that they're functioning in righteousness under the belief of their God.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the scary thing about that is that they believe they're right. They're not operating in an evil context saying we're evil and they're good and we're going to destroy them. They think they're the good.
Mm-hmm. So there are some correlations to this story to what's really going on in modern day right now.
Well, and I think a lot of it, the root of it. Now, one interesting part in a scene I wrote in the book is when Victoria meets a scientist, and he basically asks her a question. He says to her, "What do you think the experience would be of someone reading the Bible, specifically the Old Testament, for the first time? What do you think that they would experience?" And she's kind of confused, and he says, "Let me tell you what it would be." Totally untainted now, coming to this as a book they've never seen. It is a story of terrorism. It took the Israelites 500 years to take the land of Canaan, and they took it in bloodshed. And they destroyed the Philistines, the Hittites, the Canaanites, in the name of their God. And they, in the city of Jericho, they dragged men, women, and children out of their homes and beheaded them, burned them, chopped them into pieces, all this horrific violence.
Mm-hmm.
And we look at today, I was taught as a child that that was okay because they were doing it in the name of the God that I was taught is the one true God.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he tells her in the book, the scientist's name is Lazarus Coker, he says, that's terrorism. And the only reason it doesn't get reported is because there's no CNN cameras there to show the devastation that took place in Jericho.
Yeah.
But in his inference is that religion, no matter what shade you believe in, is all of it is founded or rooted in bloodshed, in terror, and violence.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? Why is there such a strong correlation with violence?
I don't know, especially when all the great spiritual masters, Jesus included, taught the exact opposite.
Exactly.
But I don't know. I think for me, being a fan and a reader of a lot of Eckhart Tolle and Deepak Chopra's stuff, I think it's the ego.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a sense of when you identify yourself with a higher power that you feel you are being charged to carry out righteousness, that you are somehow elite and selected for a mission from God, that feeds the ego and blinds the spirit.
That's so interesting. You know, a lot of people would say right now that this is reaching a new level on this planet right now with the elite. And, you know, I'm hearing a lot of references to the Nephilim and all of that. I mean, we just kind of touched on that. What do you think it is that's happening right now that is really kind of bringing all this information up into consciousness?
I think it's just part of evolution. I think that somewhere in the past, whoever did that splice, now there are many writers that have speculated that humanity, thinking man, Homo sapiens, were created to be a race of workers,
mm-hmm.
and to do mining operations and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Again, there's not a lot of evidence for that. But
this
let's
is
just,
more the extraterrestrial kind of?
Well, it could be, but you know, there's no evidence for that either. But
yes.
What we can make a safe assumption that whoever the higher power is, whether it's God or whether it's a higher evolved species that were on this planet or not, the DNA splice takes place and thinking man is quote-unquote born. And but the thing is that whoever did that didn't take into account evolution, and I think we are all still evolving, and we're evolving into consciousness, and it's gaining a lot of momentum. Now, I'll tell you something that really surprised me. The thing that I found interesting the other night watching Oprah Winfrey with my wife, who I have a tremendous amount of respect for. I think she does wonderful work.
Mm.
she is doing this whole program with Eckhart Tolle.
Yeah.
And they were talking about people's experiences that were raised as Christians. And one woman stands up and says, you know, I taught doctrine all my life, Catholic doctrine, and I never really understood why Jesus was here. I thought he came and died for my sins and so forth, but I realize now, as my own consciousness evolves, he was trying to bring to humanity the Christ consciousness, the consciousness of the anointed. And Oprah agreed. Mm. Now, that to me is a huge step, because most people that are raised in that religion cling to the fact of this death, burial, and resurrection and belief in that icon. When I saw that happening on the Oprah show, I was shocked, because here are people that have been raised in this religion and think to themselves, this is what I believe, and if I believe in Jesus as this icon, then I have eternal life because I was a sinner and he died for me. Well, the thing that I find interesting about that is, number one, people are starting to see that his teachings in a different light. Number two, I think a lot of people are starting to realize that there's no demonstrable evidence for any of that stuff.
Mm.
We don't have any evidence, even in Jesus coming from his own mouth, that he was the Messiah. That's a claim that he never made.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's
true.
Inferred. You can infer that by when Peter says, you're the Christ, the Son of God, and Jesus says, my Father in heaven has showed this to you. This is something that hasn't been taught to you by the world. I forget exactly what the quote is, but he doesn't confirm or deny. All he says to Peter is, this is where you got the information from. And even when he's in front of Pilate, Pilate says, are you the Son of God, the Christ? And he says to Pilate in no uncertain terms, that's what you say. You are saying that. There's never anywhere in those four Gospels where he stands on a mountain somewhere and says, I am the Messiah and my death will wash away the sins of the world. It's not that demonstrative.
Okay.
And I've looked, believe me, as a young man, I looked. I wanted to find that, and I never did.
Mm-hmm.
And so as consciousness rises, I think people are going to start to see the great masters, especially the ancient ones, Jesus included, and realize that, number one, Jesus' teachings were not new, and that they all point to a level of consciousness that's closer to the divine.
That's so very true, and it's there's a reevaluation going on with dogmatic religion that's combined with all of this awakening.
Right. And if you read any of Eckhart's stuff, Eckhart Tolle, he talks about the real power being in the moment. When you are able to focus and have presence in everything that you do, which I experienced in writing this book, that's where the divine power comes through. It doesn't come through dogma, and it doesn't come through belief systems. It comes through the spirit. And the only place you can touch that is in a quiet state of presence.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm really intrigued, John, to hear about your personal awakening into consciousness that started you on your path to writing and this whole journey that you're on. And then I want to hear about the Angel Hunter.
Okay. Well, I was married when I was 26. My wife was 21, and we were pretty much, we lived the yuppie life for a couple of years, and then we had children. And, I pretty much followed the model that my parents told me was, this is what you do. You get a job, and you get an education, you get a job, you get married. And as I went through that, I was fortunate enough that my wife and I were both kind of realizing that this wasn't all there was. And when I started, I finally took the initiative to say, I'm going to go and research because I was raised a Catholic, I'm going to research the history of the church that I had been told is the one true Christian church. And what I started to uncover was frightening. The destruction and the torture and the death that I read about that had gone on for centuries, including up until modern day of child abusing priests,
mm-hmm.
I thought, this is not divinely inspired. And when I read part of the letter that Paul writes to Timothy, when he says the first qualification of a church leader is that he has to be married, that's the first qualification. I thought to myself, these people don't even follow what they claim to be the written word of God.
Right.
And then I started to investigate. I started to read books by Deepak Chopra. When I started to read, especially the stuff by Eckhart Tolle, that he talks about stillness in the quiet mind and being able to touch the creative energy, which is what I like to call the cauldron of creation, which is that one true source that kind of resonates in the universe. I could only experience that when I realized my thoughts stopped, and there's the gap that the spiritual masters talk about between thought, where there is stillness and peace, where this whole creative energy field lives. Well, you can't get there under the dogmatic, because the dogmatic teach you that it doesn't exist there, it exists someplace else, and that's where you have to put your faith and your attention in order to achieve it. Well, that's a paradox, because the place that you're looking for, it isn't there. So when I was able to learn how to meditate, and I was able to quiet my mind and find the gaps. And it takes practice, but once you find the gaps and the time you spend in the gaps becomes greater, you find that all of a sudden you're walking in the state of awareness where creativity and energy starts to flow. And that's when at the time I was reading that book about the Fallen Angels by Elizabeth Prophet, and the character of Victoria found me in that in that space, in that state of awareness. And I knew that at that point that I needed to tell her story.
That's so fascinating. How did you find the gaps? What was your method?
Well, first of all, I had to realize that a lot of what I believed were just chemical reactions in my mind. They're thought processes, thought structures, mind structures. They're not real because everybody has them and everyone has different variations of them. So just because I believe something, there's a great line in the movie A Few Good Men.
Uh-huh.
And Demi Moore comes out and says to him, "Do you believe that these clients have a case?" And Tom Cruise turns to her and says, "It doesn't matter what I believe. It only matters what I can prove." And that is so profound because I realized that a lot of what I believed had no proof at all.
Mm-hmm.
Religion and other things. I believe the reason I say that is because what I found out was that most of what I believed from my spiritual religious standpoint had no evidence to support it. And the reason was because I was looking for the evidence every place except inside myself.
Mm-hmm.
So when I let go of that and I just said, I am not going to force myself to feel any certain way about what I believe, those dogmas and the theocracy just kind of dissolved.
Is this what we're seeing right now with the bridge between science and spirituality, looking at the quantum model and changing thoughts? You know, we're seeing a lot of this information coming out right now. Was that an influence for you, or is this what you're talking about?
Yeah, and I think what I figured out and agreed with what people like Eckhart and Deepak Chopra teach is that the world around us is an illusion. It's just a collection of what we would call quantum soup.
Mm.
And the only reason that it has any form is because we apply our attention to it. And it's transient. Eventually, everything that we know, you know, 1,000 years, 10,000 years, it'll all be gone. And rearranged and reformed and recreated. And that's the energy of creation, right? And you look out into the cosmos, and what do you see? We see on a grand scale galaxies colliding.
Yeah.
Suns going supernova and consuming entire solar systems. And it's what happens is that matter, those subatomic particles, are being broken apart and rearranged into new things. And it also helped me realize that the physical body we inhabit is part of that cauldron of creation.
Mm.
It comes and goes into form and then leaves again. But your energy of who you are is eternal. And one of the great things in the book that Victoria discovers in the context of trying to find her twins is that she comes across some ancient teaching that says your spirit is eternal, and fire can't burn it, water can't wet it, wind can't erode it, and weapons cannot cleave it. It's ancient, it's unborn, it's forever. And it's that conviction when she realizes that she understands her place in the universe on a much grander scale and also a much simpler one.
Mm-hmm. We are so powerful, aren't we?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the thing is that when you realize that and you just accept that and you start to tap into those powers of creation, you know, someone asked me, and I was doing a book club, and someone asked me, did you ever have writer's block? And I said, no, never.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so much energy for creation out there. What actually got published in the book, I wrote a lot more.
Interesting. That's so interesting. Okay, so tell us about The Angel Hunter. I'll clarify the time and the setting for this novel, but tell us what happens in this book.
Well, taking from some of what Elizabeth Clare Prophet says, the book, of course, is paranormal. The book opens with the prologue where it's the end of the Second World War, and Adolf Hitler is in his bunker, and he is grieving the fact that the Reich is falling around his ankles. It's over.
Uh-huh.
And in that scene, this fallen angel, this watcher, who is his father, appears to him and says, don't lament over this whole thing. When the time comes, eliminate your physical form by bullet and by poison, which is what Hitler did. He shot himself in the head and bit a cyanide capsule.
Uh-huh.
He said, after your flesh is burned, you're going to wait in the shoal, which is another word for Hades or purgatory or whatever. It's a dimension. And when the time is right, we're going to raise the Fourth Reich. Because on the horizon, I've seen a woman who is going to be the vehicle for the second generation of my offspring. So then the book goes into modern day, and it opens with Victoria's in her house, and she's breastfeeding her twin sons that are 3 months old. Now, the interesting thing is her husband is dead, and she believes at the time that this was her husband's parting gift to her
uh-huh.
with these babies.
Uh-huh.
And what happens is the her house is broken into when she's upstairs, and there are these two men with thick German accents that are going to telling her that they're going to educate her about how fortunate she is to be the mother of the new Reich. And as the conversation is taking place, she's very nervous but also very confused as to what exactly they're talking about. And it's at that point where one of the prophecies of the Book of Enoch is fulfilled, where the children are taken from among, Enoch says the children should be taken from among man, the offspring of the watchers, and cast into the lake of eternal fire.
Okay.
So the children disappear, and she wakes up in the morning with no recollection of ever having them because of the scene that took place when they were taken from her. She's suffering post-traumatic stress.
Oh, okay, so
and
shocking.
From, mm-hmm. Right, it was so shocking that she just numbed it out until people come asking her, where are your children, including her mother. And from there, it's the process of she goes through where her entire world, everything she knew, believed in, is being totally stripped away from her.
Mm-hmm.
And at a point where she actually remembers the children, it is so traumatic for her, she ends up going into a mental hospital. And the rest of the story from there is what she does, what is the fight that she's going to take.
So tell me then why it was important to bring in the Third Reich into this book.
Well, one of the theories, not just from Elizabeth Prophet, but from many theologians, is that the rise and fall of empires that are destructive, that are domineering, like the Third Reich or the parts of the Roman Empire or Babylonia, are all the result of the fact that there are this offspring of these fallen angels. So I concentrated on that because if you're going to write fiction, somewhere along the line, someone is going to go and say, geez, I want to know more about this, and they're going to go back and do some research. And as a writer, you don't ever want someone to go and find out that there's absolutely no foundation anywhere for the story you've written. So there is evidence through research that theologians and historians have done that, yes, this is plausible, that these barbaric entities, whether it's Hitler or Stalin or Napoleon, you could make the argument that they are cut from a different genetic cloth.
I've understood that the Third Reich was extremely interested in the occult and supernatural.
Yes, and at one point in the book, that's an interesting point, because at a point in the book, Victoria deals with the Spear of Destiny. And the Spear of Destiny is, by legend, the spear that pierced the side of Christ. And that was something that was sought after by conquerors from the early 2nd and 3rd century, and it was possessed by Charlemagne and a whole bunch of, right up to and including Adolf Hitler.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Where is it now?
Well, the Vatican claims to have the spear of, no, the centurion's name who pierced the side of Christ, his name is, in legend, is Longinus.
Mm-hmm.
And they claim to have the spear of Longinus in the Vatican in St. Peter's Basilica. Now, there are other places that claim to have the spear on display, which is the one that Hitler had and Charlemagne and a lot of conquerors in between.
Mm-hmm.
We have no way of knowing, of course, whether that spear is just an icon or a metaphor or is actually the spear that pierced the side of Christ. My guess is that none of them are the Spear of Destiny. It was probably gone a long time or probably melted down for something.
Sure, sure. Now, what about the Fourth Reich? Is that something you found that was factual, or is that...
Well, yeah. Factual in the sense that one of the things that one of the priests at Notre Dame tells the campus minister there, he said, listen, this evil, look at it. He said, there's a pattern here. It comes into the world, it creates all kinds of corruption and chaos, and then fades away for a while, and then it comes back. And we've seen it for thousands of years. And he says to the priest, what makes you think this is any different? And that's kind of like the context of why the Fourth Reich is eventually going to rise, because not only is the evidence from the past there, but we know that the spirits of people, the energy, it doesn't go away. You know, I kind of infer in this, there's really no such thing as hell. You know, that they're all burning in. It's a matter of choice, and they are going to, until the ego dissolves, whether it's spiritually or emotionally. These entities are going to continually reincarnate and try to wreak havoc on humanity.
That energy will still keep coming back.
Right.
Interesting. Okay.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Established in 1998, Rebecca's Reads is a book review and publicity service serving a large reading audience as well as a wide community of authors, publishers, publicists, and buyers and sellers. They offer reviews of recently published books as well as chapter readings, teasers, and videos to help you decide what book you would like to read next. Their insightful author interviews take connecting reader and author one step further, and if you decide you would like to purchase a book, an easy-to-navigate link will allow you to purchase the book immediately online. For the authors, publicists, and publishers, Rebecca's Reads has a variety of publicity services to help them market their books to their reading audience. Their services are budget-friendly and effective. For buyers and sellers, they have a monthly list of current reviews in the Book Review Index for easy browsing, as they know your time is precious and efficiency is the priority. Be sure to visit RebeccasReads.com and browse around their new space. Whatever your literary need, this user-friendly website may be just what you're looking for. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with J.A. Leary, author of The Angel Hunter. You can find out more about J.A. Leary through his website, jaleary.com. So tell us about using the University of Notre Dame as a setting. I know a lot of your book takes place there.
It does. I needed a place that was was very mystical and had it had an aura about it that transcended religion, and Notre Dame has that. Now, it's a Catholic institution, but there's a lot of history there that goes, operates outside the power of it as a learning institution, and just what it stands for operates outside, I think, the boundaries of Catholicism. Of course, the people that run the university probably would not agree with me. However, the setting there, and I also needed something to ground the character in. Victoria had to have something that she believed in, some sort of tradition. I had her raised as a Catholic, and she went to Notre Dame at a very young age because she was very bright. She graduated high school at 16 and started the university the following fall. And her experiences there is what grounded her and matured her into the point that she could carry on the fight that she has in the book. And when she goes back there, she knows that the grotto, which is the stone cave of stones, has candles in it. It's a shrine to the Virgin Mary. It's a big part. I don't want to give too much of the story away. Mm-hmm. It's a big part of what she has to understand in order to go on the quest for her children.
For her children. So talk to us about the theme of good versus evil, or what's really what the underlying theme really is. Maybe more accurately, it's inner strength versus evil or ego. I don't know what.
Yeah, the real message of it is that from a human level, is that a mother is going to go to the ends of the earth or creation to fight for her children. And that is a very human thing that doesn't have a lot of paranormal attached to it, doesn't have politics, doesn't have economics. It's a reaction at a gut level that a mother says, I will not accept this, and my children are not going to suffer if I have anything to say about it. So when you build everything else around that, you can basically put anything in there, paranormal or political or economic. The character in her fight is going to be a lot more believable because her fight is human.
Mm-hmm.
However, I do infer in a lot of places that evil is in the eyes of the beholder. As I said, people like Hitler and Heinrich Himmler and the high levels of in the Third Reich, they didn't believe what they were doing was wrong. They believed that they were under the charge of God to rid the earth of the inferior race or races. I don't think they went to bed at night and have their conscience bothering them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's so scary. They thought they believed that they were right. So when you look at it from that context, how do you decide what is and what is not evil? And to me, it comes back to consciousness. People that operate at high levels of consciousness behave a certain way. And that certain way is with kindness, understanding, compassion, and realize that humanity is part of who they are as an individual and as a collective. And when you step outside of that, that's when you get into trouble. Now, you want people label that evil? Okay, that's just a label, though. Actually, what it is, I think, is a frame of reference.
Interesting. How so?
Well, if your frame of reference is based on the fact that you feel that you are being charged by a higher power and that your belief system or your race or whatever it is superior to what you perceive next to you, whether it's black, white, Jewish or Muslim, it doesn't matter. That's going to create a problem. And the more you oppose something from a purely unconscious standpoint, the more fueled the ego is going to become.
Mm.
The more enemies you have, the more you're going to feel a defining of your own sense of self, which is an illusion. It's false. And Victoria finds that out.
Interesting. So applying that maybe to what we're seeing in the world today, would you suggest, because a lot of what we're seeing is religious fanaticism, would you say that it's just a level of unconsciousness is really becoming apparent?
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's more than, you know, you can put a label on it that says it's insanity, which it is. I mean, there's no
mm-hmm.
question. Flying planes into buildings and killing people is insane.
Yeah.
However, when you look at someone with that and you say, okay, this person, we can label this as insane, but what is the underlying cause? Well, the underlying cause has got to be, there's really no other alternative but to say these people are just unconscious. They don't realize they're destroying pieces of who they are, part of the human society, part of humanity, which they are connected with eternally, whether they like it or not, and it doesn't matter what religion or color of your skin. And I make a statement in the book in one scene where a Yale theologian is saying that the murder of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King did so much damage to the rising of consciousness in humanity and in the United States based on race relations. He said it probably he's talking to someone. He says it probably set the country and the world back 100 years or more.
Interesting.
Because I think we have leaders that come into the physical world that they have their issues too. But if you look at the track that the two men are on, Bobby Kennedy would have been elected as president in 1968,
uh-huh.
and Martin Luther King would have had a hero, a champion in the
yes.
White House
yes.
for his social perspective. And who knows what that would have done? It probably we'd be a lot further ahead today.
Oh, things would look much different. Yes,
yeah.
Most definitely. Interesting. So, you know, alongside giving readers a really exciting story, I know that it was important for you to challenge belief systems of readers through this novel, and I'd like to maybe get your thoughts on why this was so important to you. I mean, this book seems to me as a service to humanity, really.
I look at it that sort of like that in a way. Now, first and foremost, of course, if you're going to write commercial fiction and you want to make a living as a writer, you have to write page turners.
Of course.
Okay.
And
so
it is.
Right.
So that aside.
So there's that sense of the mechanics. However, once you get past that, yeah, you want people to sit back and as they read the book and when they close the last cover, I want people to sit back and say, I need to think about or maybe readdress some of my own belief systems, realizing that in the final conflict, which every book has. I won't give too much away by saying this, but in the final conflict, when you have to face who you are and what you believe and then decide whether what you're believing is an illusion or if it's real, everybody should go through that in life and have that accountability to themselves more than anything else. And that's what I tried to do in the story, to bring the reader to that position, is that as Victoria experiences those things, they experience them.
Interesting. What was it like for you writing for a female character like this, and one that had such depth and was of such importance?
Well, that's a really good question. And what I did was I had test readers. Now, I had my wife. My wife was my wife is...
She's your inspiration.
Yeah. Victoria is the archetype of Joan of Arc. My wife,
okay.
And sort of spun together into this literary character.
Mm-hmm.
So as I wrote, I would give things to her, and I'd say, what do you think about this? And she really helped me shape her into a mother. Now, the editor that I hired, the original draft of the book did not have the opening chapter with her nursing her twins. And my editor said to me, she read the first five chapters, she said, you know what, I'm sure this is good, it's going somewhere, I like it. I want to see her as a mother in the first five sentences.
Mm.
Show me her as a mother. And that was huge because everybody that tells me that they read the book, the first identifying characteristic they have with her is that she's a mother. So my test readers, I had one male. The rest of them I picked, there were four other ones. They were all women, and they all had children. And so I was able to get a lot of feedback, a lot of thumbs up and thumbs down about scenes that I wrote that helped me understand not only how she would think is a female character, but also they gave me input on things that I just don't think that way because I'm not of that sex.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
If you're going to do something like this, I tell everybody that asks me about writing, so you can't write close to the vest. You got to write the stuff and you got to put it out there and you have to let it be judged as you're writing it if you hope to succeed.
That's a really good point. Great advice. So how did you, as you were writing this character of Victoria, how did your relationship with her evolve through the writing process?
Well, that's a good question. I believed in her as a character because she was a mother, and I got all of that from how my wife is with our children.
Mm-hmm.
Very methodical in how she goes about things, makes sure they're always cared for, always knows where they are, that type of thing, you know, very, very close attention to detail. So then when the adventure starts, of course, and the heartbreak that she goes through when her children disappear, I went through periods as I wrote the book where you have to, at least as a writer for me, you have to live the story with the character. And as I wrote, if I wasn't feeling emotion, if I didn't feel anguish and I didn't feel excitement or fear as I was writing, now it's in a virtual sense, right? You don't really feel those things because you're sitting at your desk, you know, you're not really being chased by Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
However, when you go back and read it and review it, if something isn't there to make you say, yeah, this is good, I'm feeling something with the character, and then you hand it to somebody else and they're giving you that feedback and saying, yes, this is her. This is consistent. It's good. It's causing me to have an emotional reaction.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it was sort of a give and take with the character in a literary sense. However, I never got to the point, and people have asked me this on radio shows, if Victoria was just out there somewhere and she was, you know, sort of this entity out there in the world of energy that had found me and was telling me her story. And
oh, okay.
That's a little too out there, you know.
Too out there.
And I tried to tell the guy.
You're not channeling.
Right, I'm not channeling.
Mm-hmm.
I said, no, she's not real. She's a fictional literary character, powerful, very bright, very attractive. But she's made up,
mm-hmm.
and you have to keep that in mind when you're writing, because one of my agent told me was, you got to talk about her like she's real.
Yeah.
Right? You want to engage people in conversation about the character. It's never about the story. It's about the character.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to just be careful that they don't think you're a little flaky. You really believe this person exists.
That's true. That's true. So the children, you know, we haven't talked too much about the children. How strong of a role do they play in this first book? And I know that you're writing a sequel, and I'm wondering if we hear more about the children in the second book.
Yes. Well, her children are twins. They're twin boys.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, right away, the connection she feels to them is strong because it's maternal and she's a mother. The thing that I noticed, though, in my own experience as a parent is father-daughter relationships are special.
Mm.
Father-son relationships are special. Mother-daughter is special. Mother-son, that's divine.
Interesting.
The mother to the son is there's something about that holds a unique quality that is sort of tough to define. So the mother-son has enough of a mystique to it that I was able to really use that. And Victoria writes, she has a book, a journal that she keeps in the story called A Mother's Epiphany. And her epiphany was what she went through. It was actually the beginning of her rise to consciousness when these children were born. So in the first book, they're a motivator for her. They're pushing her to limits that she never thought she would go to before she became a mom. In the second book, there is going to be more about what their actual destiny is, but it's not going to be cliche that, you know, their destiny is to grow up and someday save the world. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's a lot more simplistic, but it's also a lot more powerful,
mm.
what they're going to do. And it's not just what they're going to do as individuals, it's how they're connected to their mother through the remaining of the series of books.
Mm. Well, so how many books are going to be in this series?
Well, I think there's probably going to be at least three. That, of course, that depends on a lot of factors.
Sure.
As you evolve as a writer, you might think that things that you want to write about today, you might not want to write about tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
And it also depends on how much, there's going to be some really deep concepts in there. And one of the things she's going to explore as a character is what we talked about of where in antiquity does humanity come from? Where was the DNA splice?
Mm-hmm.
Who did it?
Definitely.
And you got to kind of gauge on how much weight or how much you can really throw at a reader in one book.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's so interesting. I think that there's a thirst for this kind of fiction right now with those underlying types of messages, themes, bits from history. I think that people are hungry for that.
Yeah, I think so too.
Mm-hmm.
And if you weave it in there, as any writer that does this, if you weave it in there, and it's smooth, and you can experience what the character is finding out not only about themselves but about what they've been taught and what's true and what isn't. it makes it all the better because they can relate to it. The reader can relate to it and say, geez, I've had the same questions for years.
So was The Angel Hunter kind of your version of some of these the spiritual fiction books we're seeing out there, like, you know, in the 90s, the Celestine Prophecy, and more recently, The Da Vinci Code?
Yeah, I think that's you could put it in that category, sure, but the I don't think that my approach as a writer was that laid out. You know, I came to this conscious awakening, and I had this story that germinated inside me that I knew I had to write. I never set out to be a writer and never saw myself as a writer when I was younger. So how the story ended up in the context it's in and where it's going to go, where Victoria Hunter is going to go in the series of books, I'm kind of letting the energies of creation